Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso. Today we have some news about some major land use controversies here in East County. Hear why residents of Rancho San Diego and Jamul are fighting to oppose a sand mine proposed at the site of Cottonwood Golf Course, adjacent to homes and a national wildlife refuge along the Sweetwater River. In La Mesa, learn about efforts by the state of California to open a parole facility at the base of Mount Helix, a plan that teachers, parents, and residents say could put neighbors and students at risk. On our health report, get the latest news about an expanded ground beef recall. And then on Crime Beat, we have news about a bizarre assault on a horse in rural East County. Hear why SDG&E is proposing utility rate reforms. And then on People Power, learn how the county is brightening this holiday season for some foster children in need. Plus, get some tips on how to keep your pets safe this holiday season. From Public News Service, we'll have some national stories, including a candidate who has withdrawn his concession in a North Carolina congressional race after evidence of voting fraud involving absentee ballots has been revealed. Then hear why California is expanding Medi-Cal for undocumented immigrants and learn how the immigration controversy is affecting Christmas tree farms. And on the second half of our show today, we'll be re-airing a couple of our seasonal favorites from years past, including Helen Oldfield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society recounting Christmas memories of long ago by Dr. McGregor, an early resident of Lemon Grove. And since Pearl Harbor Day was last week, we'll be replaying our interview with Dr. Kenneth Hansen, sharing his recollection as a child in Hawaii of the bombing of Pearl Harbor. We'll also have some Christmas tree tips for you, and then from Public News Service, hear how the California Legislature's first bill being introduced in the new legislative session seeks to counter environmental rollbacks by the Trump administration. And this holiday season, we'll share some country Christmas music, courtesy of the U.S. Army Band, as well as some Christmas memories in Acapulco from local reporter Nadine Abbott. So stay tuned for all of these stories on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. And from all of us at the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, to all of you, we wish you a very Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and a joyous holiday season.
Opposition is growing to a proposed sand mining project on the site of Cottonwood Golf Course on Willow Glen Road in Rancho San Diego. In late November, a crowd of over 200 people packed into the Rancho San Diego Library Community Room for a meeting organized by Stop Cottonwood Sand Mine, a coalition of residents from Rancho San Diego and Jamul opposed to the project. The group has set up a website, stopcottonwoodsandmine.com, where people can download petitions to circulate and submit before a county deadline for initial public comments on December 19th. Official public comments for or against the project can also be sent directly to bronwyn.brown@sdcounty.ca.gov. You can find that email address and more information at eastcountymagazine.org, at the County Department of Planning and Land Use, as well as the stopcottonwoodsandmine.com website. Barry Jantz, spokesman for the opposition, urged concerned citizens to sign up at the site to receive notification of future meetings and community input opportunities during an approval process that could take months or years. You can also ask the county's Department of Planning and Land Use to be added to their contact list on the project to receive information on all sides of the issue. Beverly Hills-based investor Michael Schlesinger has purchased several failing golf courses, including Cottonwood, which he acquired in 2015 after the previous owner filed for bankruptcy. Schlesinger has let one of the golf courses go fallow, green grasses now brown, a pond once used by wildlife drained. The site is zoned recreational, with the golf course listed as a buffer zone to sensitive habitat in the adjacent federal wildlife refuge along the Sweetwater River. The developer claims mining is allowed by right but residents argue that the proposed use is incompatible with current zoning. Schlesinger proposes to convert the golf courses to a sand mine over the next 10 years to meet the region's shortage of sand aggregate needed for roadways. The project would yield an estimated 7.5 million tons of aggregate, pumping $40 million into potential profits into Schlesinger's pockets. The mining would be done in three phases, with restoration of the land proposed over the 2 years once the 10-year mining operation is completed. The project would ultimately require approval by the County Board of Supervisors after first being heard by the Valle de Oro Planning Group and the County Planning Commission. According to a report prepared by Schlesinger by the consulting group Enviromine, sand mining would operate 5 days a week with trucking starting as early as 4 a.m. Residents have voiced alarm over potential noise, traffic, pollution of air and water in the Sweetwater River, impacts on wildlife in the adjacent federally owned San Diego National Wildlife Refuge is also a concern. In addition, local realtors have advised that the project could significantly drive down property values of nearby homes. A rock quarry just up the road east of Cottonwood has been viewed as a nuisance by some neighbors impacted by blasting, including a homeowner with a golf course view who says the quarry blasting makes her whole house shake. At the meeting, another resident summed up concerns of many, stating, "I moved into this community because of the peace and quiet, not to be living next to an active sand mine." John Cloud, whose family has been in the mine development in the area since 1940s, is the spokesman for Enviromine, the project's consultant. He told our reporter, "I understand that people are in fear of change," but adds, "I know that we are not going to assuage all of our fears, but we can back them off from the ledge, so you don't need to jump because the impact is not near what you're envisioning." But during the meeting, when Cloud said that residents should dial it back and not voice concerns, yet despite the county's open public comment period, opposition organizer Elizabeth Urquhart bristled. She said the project will affect homes, schools, businesses, and others in the community. Steel Canyon and Sequon golf courses are also nearby, along with tribal lands, an elementary school, and a high school. The opposition group is seeking people with expertise in topics ranging from biology to real estate to help out as the project proceeds. They hope to soon collect funds to battle the project through means ranging from billboards to potentially lawsuits. Community opposition to a sand mine at Cottonwood is similar to the sentiments among residents of Lakeside's El Monte Valley, who are also combating a proposed sand mine that could disrupt their rural way of life for dozens of years or more. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Chardé Fontenot.
The state of California wants to lease space for a parole office in a newly constructed office building on Grossmont Summit Drive in La Mesa. It's located at the base of Mount Helix in a mostly residential neighborhood next to the Brigantine Restaurant. It's just across the freeway from Grossmont High School, which many students access across a bridge just one block from the proposed parole office. The facility would have 65 staff members, including 52 parole agents, meeting with potentially thousands of parolees who serve time in state prisons for serious crimes. Neighbors, parents, and teachers are organizing opposition to the proposal. They are concerned about criminals in close proximity to school children and residents, as well as nearby businesses. Parking is also an issue, since the building only has 41 parking spaces. The property is zoned for residential and business uses, but not commercial. There is no mass transit nearby. The closest bus stop is a 20-minute walk away. The nearest trolley station, at Amaya on the other side of the freeway, would mean parolees would have to walk past a public park, two schools, and athletic fields used by children and teens. Daniel Botin, a real estate consultant, believes the site is incompatible with current zoning and could endanger minors. He started a petition at change.org calling on the State Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation to stop the parole facility from opening in La Mesa. Hundreds of people have posted opposition on the Mount Helix Next Door forum and or signed the petition. But Mark Roback, the leasing agent representing the building's landlord, claims use as a parole facility is allowed by right under the zoning. Roback says the state is looking for a private location where they won't disrupt neighbors. He notes that the location is at the end of a cul-de-sac, though that's adjacent to the parking lot for the Brigantine Restaurant. He says he is not aware of problems caused by parole or probation offices in other areas such as El Cajon or Chula Vista. We asked the state agency how many parolees would be supervised at the facility, and whether crime rates have risen in other local communities where a parole facility has opened. But the department refused to answer any questions after providing its initial brief statement on the proposed project. La Mesa City Manager Yvonne Garrett says the city attorney and staff are reviewing the proposal and considering their options. La Mesa Councilman Bill Baber says there was no discussion of a parole facility when the city approved the construction of the building, adding that he just learned of the proposal and is not certain whether the use is allowed by right or whether the city may have the power to take action. An attorney who represents criminal defendants told ECM that parolees have been known to hide knives or drugs outside before seeing their parole officers. He says the La Mesa site is a, quote, terrible location for a parole office. Neighbors are also angry that the state's notification to the city about the project lists a wrong number for the district administrator in charge. Following complaints, a phone number was later provided. Luis Bettino, spokesman for the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, did send us an email saying that the agency strives to improve public safety by supervising and helping to reintegrate parolees back into their neighborhoods through rehabilitative programs. The parolees who would be served by the office all lived in East County before they were incarcerated, he notes, adding, "These are ongoing lease negotiations at this time that are being discussed with the city, and those have not been finalized." Supervisor Diane Jacob has no jurisdiction over the project, which is not under county control, but says she will send a letter to the Department of Corrections voicing concerns over the project. Some community members have also reached out to newly elected State Senator Brian Jones's office, as well as to the offices of Assemblyman Randy Vopel and Assemblywoman Shirley Weber, to voice their concerns, since the parole facility could affect constituents in all of their districts. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
This is John Fisteer with a health alert. Over 250 people nationwide have fallen ill from salmonella tied to contaminated ground beef, including 66 cases in California, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control reports. Over 12 million pounds of ground beef have been recalled, all packaged between July 26th and September 7th, but health officials warn that some products may still be in consumers' freezers. After an October recall, a second recall was issued in December, bringing the total to 17 million pounds of potentially tainted products. The recalled beef was sold at major retailers, including Walmart's, Sam's Club, Sprouts, Ralph's, Food for Less, and others. Consumers should return the recalled ground beef to retailers or throw it away. Call your doctor if you develop symptoms of cramps, fever, or diarrhea within 3 days after eating a contaminated ground beef product.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Chardé Pontneau with a Crime Beat report. The Sheriff's Department is investigating a bizarre assault in the Blossom Valley area of unincorporated El Cajon against a horse. Warning, this story contains graphic content. On the morning before Thanksgiving, a stable owner found a female horse at her facility with a rope tied around her head. The mare also had a leg tied to a bar and her tail tied in an upward position. The case is similar to a horse assault that occurred several years ago in Lakeside, in which an arrest was made. A veterinarian has taken DNA samples to help authorities determine who molested the horse in Blossom Valley. Fortunately, the mare did not thrash around or suffer other injuries. The owner of the stable says she plans to install surveillance cameras to protect the horses at her facility and provide evidence if the intruder returns. Anyone with information on this crime is asked to please contact the Sheriff's Department.
San Diego Gas and Electric has filed a request with the California Public Utilities Commission to eliminate the state-mandated high usage charge, which impacted more than 105,000 customers this past summer. Eliminating the charge for high energy users would minimize bill spikes during months when energy usage is high. The high usage charge led to higher bills for ratepayers who used more than 400% of their baseline allowance. On average, these customers would have saved approximately $30 per month without the high usage charge, though some saw their bills spike by hundreds of dollars. Scott Kreider, SDG&E's Vice President of Customer Service, says, "It was a challenging summer for our customers, particularly for people who experienced dramatic increases in their bills, due in part to the high usage charge." He says the company wants to provide relief from those high bills that promoted a flood of complaints from customers this summer. San Diego Gas and Electric is also exploring other proposals over the coming months. These include eliminating seasonal pricing to stabilize bills, shifting timing of the climate credit into a one-month lump sum in August to create a savings when bills are higher due to increased energy use, and conducting a new baseline allowance study to reflect changing climate and energy choices. If the Public Utilities Commission approves SDG&E's request, the company hopes to eliminate the high usage charge by June, before summer heat sends rates soaring again. Residents can also avoid the high usage charge by enrolling in one of several time-of-use pricing plans which are not subject to the charge. More information about time-of-use pricing plans can be found at sdgne.com/whenmatters. That's WHENMATTERS. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fisteer.
This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world.
This is Chardé Fontenot with East County Magazine's People Power Report. Some San Diego County foster families have received some special help to bridge the digital divide. Computer access is common, but it hasn't reached all homes. So the county and the San Diego Futures Foundation teamed up to distribute computers to 150 foster families this holiday season. Supervisor Greg Cox has helped pass out the computers during the annual giveaway event. The computers were formerly used by county employees, then refurbished to be distributed to the families.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region. You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
It's time to deck the halls for the holiday season, but some holiday decorations can pose safety hazards for your cat or dog. So San Diego County's Animal Service Department is offering these tips to protect your pet. Keep pets away from mistletoe, holly, and poinsettias since these are toxic to animals. Consider using artificial holiday plants instead. Chocolate is toxic to pets, so keep stockings with chocolate treats out of reach, as well as any chocolate cookies you might leave out for Santa. Anchor your Christmas tree so pets can't tip it over. Clear fishing twine tied to the top of the tree and secured to a ceiling or wall is a simple way to keep your tree standing and protect your ornaments too. Never use tree preservatives in water in your Christmas tree stand since this can be deadly if cats or dogs drink it. Cats love to play with tinsel and curling ribbon, but then they'll try to eat it. Tinsel is toxic and ribbon can obstruct your pet's intestinal tract. So keep these items away from curious critters. Hide electrical cords from your pets and make sure they can't play with or knock over any candles. Many dogs and cats get overwhelmed with all the hustle and bustle of the holidays, so having a quiet room allows them to escape and sleep undisturbed. On New Year's Eve, loud booms from fireworks can scare your canine companion. Some dogs will jump over fences to escape the noise. They run for miles and become lost. So set aside a safe, quiet place and be sure your dog is wearing identification just in case. Microchip both dogs and cats, since they slip out the door unnoticed while you're busy greeting holiday visitors. And if someone finds your lost pet, a vet's office or shelter can scan for a microchip and you can easily be reunited. County Animal Service offers low-cost microchipping every Tuesday through Sunday, which includes national registration. You can also sign up for Finding Rover and upload a photo of your pet using your computer or smartphone. This free service uses facial recognition to help lost and found dogs be reunited with their owners. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Chardé Fontenot.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast. I'm Mike Clifford. Democrat Dan McCready takes back his concession in the still undecided race for Congress in North Carolina. Also on the Friday rundown, California moves to provide Medi-Cal for undocumented immigrants, and tighter immigration enforcement may make it harder for you to find a Christmas tree. First, our top story, Democrat Dan McCready announced Thursday that he is withdrawing his concession in the race for the North Carolina 9th Congressional District. The Hill reporting the move comes amid an investigation into potential election fraud. McCready trails the Republican by 905 votes, but the Hill notes in the weeks since the midterm elections, the State Board of Elections voted not to certify the election results as it continues to investigate allegations of electoral fraud and other voting irregularities related to absentee ballots. California lawmakers have just introduced a pair of bills that would extend Medi-Cal coverage to low-income, undocumented immigrant adults.
A recent UC Berkeley study found California has 3 million uninsured adults, and 1.4 million of them are undocumented and could apply if they meet the income requirements. Assemblymember Joaquin Arambula, a former ER doctor who introduced Assembly Bill 4, says he's seen the suffering that comes with having no access to health insurance or preventive care.
When you care about them, you make the cost-effective investment into the community to keep them healthy, rather than allowing them to deteriorate and become sick because of preventable causes.
The Senate version was sponsored by State Senators Ricardo Lara and Maria Elena Durazo. Arambula sees health care as a human right and wants to move toward universal health care. Opponents say such a system would be too expensive. In 2015, California extended Medi-Cal to 250,000 undocumented children. I'm Suzanne Potter.
During the last legislative session, two similar but more modest bills did not make it past the finish line. Meantime, the Trump administration has announced plans to roll back protections on sage-grouse habitat across 7 western states, including Colorado, in order to open up millions of acres to drilling, mining, and other resource extraction.
Conservation groups say the move could unravel years of stakeholder collaboration to keep the iconic bird off the endangered species list. Ken Raitt with the Pew Charitable Trust says the proposal would eliminate habitat protections on 80% of the lands designated under the 2015 plans.
The BLM is choosing to upend scientifically based, locally supported plans to benefit the energy development industry, for whom 4/5 of the public lands are not enough.
The changes would apply to 1.7 million acres of BLM-managed lands in northwest Colorado. Sage steppe habitat is not only important for the bird known for its impressive mating dance, but more than 350 other species, including mule deer, elk, and pronghorn. The Interior Department says it will continue to protect sage-grouse and that the move comes at the request of states for more flexibility on public lands. I'm Eric Galatis.
Sage-grouse populations have declined by nearly 95% from historic levels. The BLM will accept public comments through January the 8th. School kids in Missouri were so eager to participate in the No Kid Hungry Innovation Challenge that it was a full house when they pitched their ideas for reducing child hunger and food insecurity.
The challenge distributed $14,000 in grants to students who had the most innovative ideas for increasing access to or participation in school nutrition programs. That means school meals and snacks or summer meal programs funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. John Berry, the director of No Kid Hungry Missouri, says it was an opportunity to see hunger through the eyes of students.
To bring students together to help us generate ideas that the students thought were going to be good solutions, workable solutions to solving or addressing child hunger in their communities.
The most recent estimate by Missouri's Kids Count shows that 18.6% of the state's kids are growing up in homes that experience food insecurity. I'm Roz Brown.
The No Kid Hungry Innovation Challenge was launched in 2016 with support from groups like the Family and Community Trust, Gen Youth, Adventure Capital, and the Midwest Dairy Council. Finally, Christmas trees will be available this holiday season, although growers say they've had a tougher time getting balsam, Fraser, and other fir tree varieties for purchase.
President Donald Trump's effort to restrict legal and illegal immigration at the nation's borders have meant fewer migrant workers filling tree farms with the seasonal labor they need. Gary Thomas, who heads the Maryland Christmas Tree Association, says the lack of workers has an impact on tree availability nationally, and he expects to see shortages in some parts of the country.
I've talked to farmers in North Carolina, as well as out in the Midwest, as well as on the West Pacific Northwest, that we don't have enough help.
Thomas said he's seen some of the largest Christmas tree growing states along the East Coast, such as North Carolina and Pennsylvania, suffer the most from the immigrant restrictions. Some farms that used to employ 25 workers are now trying to get by with about 10. I'm Tramell Gomes.
By the way, advocates say negative environmental impacts should keep people from turning to artificial trees as they eventually end up in landfills. And for every live tree the industry produces, two or three others are planted in its place. I'm Mike Clifford, and thanks for wrapping up your week, newsin' and cruisin' with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history. It's the holiday season in warm, sunny East County. As we count our blessings, we can't help but think of those who also walked beneath that same benevolent sun years ago in somewhat less happy circumstances. One such person was Dr. Eben McGregor, one of very few doctors in East County in the 1930s. And the only game in town in Lemon Grove. Here are his words, written on Christmas Day, 1956, nearly 60 years ago. I awakened this morning thinking of my early days in Lemon Grove and of the dusty but very pretty little town as I first saw it. Oh, little town of Lemon Grove, thousands of lemon trees, nearly everyone had a horse. Lots of people had asthma and had come here for the good climate. I thought of S.D. Eckler on Central Avenue, who came here with $30,000 and sunk it into land that was ruined by the Mattoon Act in the 1930s. Eckler started a huge rabbit ranch. Poor man took credit in the 30s so people could have rabbit stew. I recall Dr. Charles Good, the dentist, with a big citrus ranch and a nice house, also on Central Avenue. He fixed your teeth for a dollar in the 1930s. And good old Ed Fells, of the Fells Naphtha soap fortune. Not that he had any of that money. He taught me lobster fishing, completely illegal, and the ocean was cold in winter. I thought of that awful segregation case the school board started when they built the Mexican school, and then the Mexicans went on strike at the packing house. How the school board thereafter began to eliminate the Mexicans from the payroll. People like Andy Anderson, good people, Art Ahrens, Reverend Kurtz, and Herman Przybylski were part of that mess. Herman Przybylski had come here from Poland. He had a big citrus ranch and horses. He thought I was a communist because I had run for office on the Democratic ticket. I didn't know the meaning of the word communist in those days. But Herman had me investigated, and I will never forget when he came over and told me I was okay. We lived across the street from each other, for Pete's sake. I was his doctor. And no communist either. That reminded me of Herman's boy Frank, who had terrible asthma and was good friends with the adopted son of Colonel and Mrs. Bryan, who lived in the big show place where Ambassador Hayes, later President Hayes, had visited. The adopted son was always tippling in the parlor and helping himself to the brandy during tea parties. But most of all, I remember Tony Sonka. He, who ran the famous general store next door to my home and medical office on Main Street, I remember saying to Tony, "Do you remember that truck that came through Lemon Grove on Christmas with flour and potatoes and somebody's old clothes and other stuff? It was all for the needy. You loaned us a little house to store the clothes. The Depression had struck so hard. I had several thousand patients who had no money. One month I worked from dawn to dusk 7 days a week, and I took in $86 in cash. Tony, you fed them, and I tried to keep them alive." Dear listeners, those were the words of Dr. Eben McGregor, who went on to lead the Veterans Administration for President Franklin Roosevelt in World War II. Dr. McGregor's house was designed by the great Alberto Traganza, also a Lemon Grove resident. That was in 1932, but it took 4 years to build because the doctor had no money, because his patients had no money. Patients with construction skills worked off their bills in sweat equity on the good doctor's house. It still stands today on Main Street, an important historic site. For the Sounds of History, I'm Helen Ofield.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine and KNSJ. Today, I'm very honored to have as my guest Ken Hansen, my next-door neighbor. All week, we've been talking with staff and friends and people across East County about their most interesting holiday recollections. And so today, Ken is going to share one of his. But first, a little bit of background. Ken, you were just a young man when your family moved to Hawaii in 1937. I understand that was a very auspicious day.
That is correct. We sailed on the old Malolo from Los Angeles to San Francisco and then to Hawaii. And the day that we sailed from San Francisco was the day that Amelia Earhart went down.
My goodness.
And which became the headline news for days and weeks.
Around the world.
So that was in a sense, made that day very special that I remember sailing for Hawaii to live. And I was very excited about the whole thing. Also, we sailed under the Golden Gate Bridge weeks after it had opened.
Ah, San Francisco.
That, too, was very exciting as I think back.
Now, fast forward a couple of years to December 7th, 1941. You were living in Honolulu. That holiday season, or just before the Christmas season, when Pearl Harbor was bombed. What was the first inkling you had that something was very wrong?
I lived in Honolulu at the time. I was home with my father and a university student who lived with us.
And you were how old?
I was 13 in eighth grade, and we could hear noises off in the distance, rumblings. But there had been a lot of preliminary building up of defense-type noises prior to this day as the possibility of war had escalated. So nothing much was made of these sounds except that one of us said, "That must be Punch Bowl erupting."
The volcano.
Punch Bowl is an extinct volcano in Honolulu, which is now a national cemetery of renown.
But at that time,
it was a place where we went for picnics. Well, obviously, Punch Bowl wasn't erupting, and we had a frantic telephone call from my aunt, mm-hmm. who lived in a home on the beach beside Diamond Head. And she had seen with her own eyes a Japanese plane go by very low, so that she actually had eye contact, she thought, with the pilot.
Wow.
And she frantically called us and said that we are being attacked and don't move, like everybody else was saying.
Now, you were taking a typing class in school at the time, and I understand that very night you sat down at home with your typewriter and you typed up a memoir. I can't
believe that I did it, but yes, I was taking typing. And, of course, had just been to class, the last class on Friday.
Would you be willing to read it to us?
Sure. I'll read part of it, and we can talk about part of it, too.
And you've told me this was one of the most memorable days in your life?
This was indeed a memorable day in that things stand out so clearly even now, just as the other day in my life, my wedding day, stands out with great detail. I call this Memoirs of a Bombay Day. That was my 13-year-old sense of humor. We were having breakfast, as usual, on Sunday morning, Nabucco, the university student at our house, and I, when we heard a faint rumbling in the distance. Nabucco went to the door and said to me, "Punch bowl must be erupting." Well, we just laughed and forgot about that. And that was around 7:45 or 8 o'clock. And about a quarter to nine, I was getting ready to go to Sunday school, which I was supposed to do, when my aunt called frantically from where she lived off of Diamond Head on the beach and said, "Turn the radio on quickly," that Waianae was under fire. Waianae was one of the areas that was hit, but only one of many. We turned it on right away and were just in time to hear that Oahu was under attack, that we should stay calm, go at once to our houses, stay put, and keep the radio on all time. My father heard this, I'm ad-libbing now, and he found this very hard to believe, as did many people in the islands, that something actually bad was happening. They wanted to assume that this was practice.
Sure.
And it wasn't real, but wow, it was real.
It had to be terrifying for you.
I wasn't terrified. This was a sense of thrill and excitement and fear all mixed up in a 13-year-old's mind. My mother was away at the time that this was happening.
Back to the memoir now.
Yes. When my daddy just laughed and said it was all practice or something like that, not to worry about it, she called, again frantically like my aunt, and said what she was seeing. She happened to be working with a group of university students on an area called Aiea Heights, which overlooks Pearl Harbor. So she sat there and was seeing what was happening. And she, too, said, "Don't move. I'll get home with the car as soon as I can." She had three students that she had to take home first. Announcements kept coming over the wire saying for no one to go out on the streets and for everyone to get off and stay off them. Daddy still laughed and said that since Sunday school was not very far away, that I might as well go. I refused. Meanwhile, we could see puffs of smoke coming up over the hills and hear what sounded like shooting and so forth. I begged to stay home. Then Mother got home, and she was able to describe precisely what she had been seeing. But I must say that even then, my father had trouble believing it. When he saw it in print, the first newspapers came out a little later in the morning through the neighborhoods, extra, extra, and he could see it. He gave in.
Your parents were very involved in this whole thing. Your mother, I understand, had a very close call herself.
She had to drive home, and there were several areas where anti-aircraft fire had come from Pearl Harbor into Honolulu. There was no actual bombing of Honolulu, but there were places where fires were started, and she could have been hit by an anti-aircraft.
It was shrapnel.
Shrapnel, yeah, whatever. Anyway, she got home safely, delivered her students, and all was well.
Your father worked at the university.
Yes. My dad worked for the Agricultural Extension Service at the University of Hawaii. And with his expertise, he and others in his office were immediately taken by the government. First of all, military rule took over immediately that day. Mm. Military rule was called. And he and others were called to the Capitol downtown. They cleared the throne room of the thrones and put in desks immediately. So the very next day, Monday, he was at a desk down there helping to assess the food situation for Oahu and the other islands, finding out how much was available and where it was available and how it was going to be distributed.
I understand that your father also wrote a memoir, Ken, of that time. Could you read a little bit of what he wrote?
He did, with considerable detail, and we are certainly grateful to him for having sat down and done that in the midst of a terribly busy time. He was working at the Extension Service in food distribution and production, and the director already had a job on the Territorial Food Committee, and they went to work even Sunday morning, and by Monday my father was in his office at the Capitol. Inventories of food and feed were made instantly. I'm reading from his own writing. The grocery stores were crowded and then ordered closed Tuesday for inventory. Note that the situation is different here than on the mainland. 65% of our food, and again I'm quoting, is imported. And if no ships come in, we eat sparingly. Wednesday, when the stores were opened, and normal requirements were sold, but the shelves were low. The big wholesalers hold the keys, which appear to be good. There are relatively few wholesalers in town, and inventories were easily made. One small job I had to do was get information from 15 dealers of food by Monday morning between 11 and 11:45. The Central Committee met at Iolani Palace by noon. We are now standing by for more. This was written the day after.
Yeah, and your father's name was?
Kenneth Hansen.
Just like yours, so Kenneth Hansen.
Yep.
The second. Very good. Thank you for sharing that. So what was that first night like? Here you're at home, the island's just been bombed.
The first night was certainly memorable for an excitable 13-year-old.
You've written about it, I see.
Our house was situated on a hill, and we normally had a nice view with many lights to be seen. Of course, this was total blackout then, and we sat and peered out the windows at total blackness. And the big thing was not knowing, were they coming back? Were they coming back that night? Were they going to land the next day on the beaches? Were they coming to get us? What was going to happen?
We did
not know. Manoa Valley, where I lived, was usually bright with lights, and it was gray as the mountains behind it. Every so often we could see a blue light from a car, but they did not last long. About 8:15, we managed to find our beds and pile in them. I think all of us were glad to do so.
Now, you were active in the Boy Scouts at the time, and I understand that they helped with some of the things that needed to be done.
Yeah, at the time I was in Troop 1 of Honolulu, and the very next day, by afternoon, they had gotten hold of us and corralled us, and we met at a school, and we were trucked downtown Honolulu, where we were assigned to the city hall, well, other places too, but I was at the city hall. We helped with sandbagging.
Sandbagging to protect against shrapnel.
Building up against the buildings, yes. We were supposed to be messengers and take messages from one downtown building to another, which didn't particularly happen. But again, looking up to the sky and hearing or seeing a plane made us wonder if they were coming back. Nobody knew who was coming or when. So that was part of the excitement and fear of the day. It was a mixture of excitement and fear.
Now, you also volunteered at a hospital with the Scouts.
Well, with the Scouts, we were out of school for 2 months or more.
No school for 2 months.
And most of the time we were busy, thanks to the Scouts, because we were assigned to such jobs as handing out gas masks at schools, helping with draft physicals because there was major drafting going on at the time, and working at a hospital, carrying boxes and doing whatever needed doing. Every place was a beehive of activity, and it was good. It kept us off the streets and doing something that was
trouble.
That was helpful.
There you go.
Yes, indeed.
Now, when Christmas came along, it was very different that year. Obviously, no holiday lights. The blackout was still
effect. Total blackout. Christmas came along 2.5 weeks later.
Did you have a Christmas tree?
And no Christmas trees. A freighter carrying evergreens from the state of Washington was torpedoed somewhere between Washington and Honolulu, and that would have been most of the trees that people would have bought.
Mm-hmm.
So
what
down,
did you do?
Down they went. So we had to make do. We pulled up banana leaves and other things from the yard or the yard next door, and we got out the ribbons and the ornaments and put them on. Of course, no lights because at that time we at night had only a storeroom with no windows to sit in if we wanted to be up and at 'em.
Wow.
Eventually the kitchen was blacked off with denim and tape and stuff so we could sit in the kitchen. But it's pretty hot and humid in Hawaii, and it wasn't...
Yes, it is.
It wasn't pleasant sitting in a room all evening. So.
No, you're used to opening the windows and enjoying those ocean
breezes.
Yeah,
so then it had to be dark.
Now, for holiday dinner, was that affected?
I can't remember our holiday dinner. We were with my uncle and aunt and family, and...
You've told me that traditionally in your family, your grandfather owned a turkey ranch someplace.
Yeah, we expected a turkey from California, since my grandfather owned a turkey ranch and usually had a turkey or two fattened up, especially for us, for the holidays.
But not that year?
No, it may have been that year we had it for Thanksgiving. I just don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, it probably went down on another ship.
Oh, my goodness. So this went on for 4 years. You stayed in the islands throughout the war, I understand.
Yes, yes. We stayed until it was time for me to go away to college. An amazing time to have lived there. In many ways, we were probably like normal teenagers, but our schooling was disrupted because The armed forces took over many of the schools. My particular school, called an intermediate school, was divided in three parts, and we were left with the Quonset hut-type part of the school, and the main part was taken over by the Army, and we had classes only half a day, and other parts of our school had to go to elementary schools that were available for other half days. So we were divided up into actually three parts and scattered around the city. And then when it came time for high school, 10th grade, and I was transferred to Punahou School, the Army had the school, and we were given and using a building at the University of Hawaii. The School of Education was our school until August of 1945, and the war was over, and the Army immediately gave the school back, and there was a frantic rush to put it back in order.
Now, you went on later in life to become a very successful doctor. Did those early days working in that hospital and seeing all the injuries and the suffering that you must have seen as a young man, did that influence your decision to want to help people by becoming a physician?
I'm pretty sure it did. I think really of those first days of the war when I got to be in the hospital and going all over and carrying things and having a feel for it. And then 2 years later, along around 10th grade, I had a summer job at the hospital where I really saw things going on and had a good feel for it and felt like I liked it. I didn't mind the sights and so forth and so on, working with patients, carrying dishes, and so forth.
Well, there you go.
So that must have been an influence as I look back, yes.
So often this time of year we hear the term peace on earth, and I think a lot of us probably don't stop to reflect on how much we take that for granted until you've been through something like the bombing of Pearl Harbor and have gone on to tell about that.
Yes, peace on earth escaped us that year, 1941, and through the awful years of the Second World War. And during this time, I, of course, along with my schoolmates, matured and learned something about the world, and by the time the war was over, we knew an awful lot more than we did as eighth graders when it all started.
I can imagine. Well, Ken, thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show here on KNSJ.
It is a pleasure to be here and think about it and talk about it.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
If you're purchasing an artificial holiday tree, look for the label Fire Resistant. When purchasing a live tree, be sure to check for freshness. When setting up the tree at home, keep it away from fireplaces and radiators. Heated rooms dry live trees out rapidly, so be sure to keep the stand filled with water and use only lights that have been tested for safety by a recognized testing laboratory. Check each set of lights, new and old, for broken or cracked sockets, frayed or bare wires, and throw out any damaged sets. Replace burned out bulbs promptly with the same wattage. Use no more than three standard size sets of lights for each single extension cord. Don't use electric lights on a metallic tree. The tree could become charged with electricity from faulty lights, and a person touching a branch could actually be electrocuted. Turn off all lights when you go to bed or leave the house. The lights could short out and start a fire. Never use lighted candles on a tree. In homes with small children, take special care to avoid sharp or breakable decorations. Keep ornaments with small removable parts out of the reach of children or pets. And don't use tree preservatives if you have pets or small children, because drinking the water could be toxic. Happy holidays and stay safe.
California's first state Senate bill of the new session, SB 1, is an effort to combat the Trump administration's environmental rollbacks by requiring state rules to be at least as strict as those in place before January 2017, when President Barack Obama left office. The current administration has already repealed dozens of environmental rules, from protections for wetlands and smaller streams to regulating the release of greenhouse gases from oil and gas wells on federal land. Kim Delfino with Defenders of Wildlife says California can't just stand by when Congress or federal agencies cave to special interests.
This bill was introduced to provide a backstop within state law so that if further weakening occurs, that we can continue to rely on the fact that we will have clean air, clean water, and protections for endangered species in California.
Other federal rollbacks under discussion would weaken car emission standards that reduce air pollution, sonic testing rules meant to help marine mammals, and habitat conservation measures. President Donald Trump has said environmental controls are excessive, strangle commercial activity, and cost jobs. The administration has also looked at weakening protections for fish like salmon and smelt in order to bring more water to farmers. Delfino maintains the state can't afford to lose important species.
And this would direct our state Fish and Wildlife Commission to evaluate all of those species that are currently on the federal endangered species list for inclusion on our state endangered species list.
The requirement would kick in only if the feds try to remove species protections. A similar bill, which stalled during the last legislative session, was opposed by oil companies, the California Chamber of Commerce, the California Farm Bureau, and the Western State Petroleum Association. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
And now we hope our listeners will enjoy
this excerpt from the U.S. Army Band Christmas Concert back in 2009. It's got a little bit of country in it for our East County listeners.
Memories of Christmas Past in Acapulco. When growing up, every December my dad drove us to Acapulco for the winter holiday. It was great to leave Mexico City for those 2 weeks. We kids always had a lot of fun. Suffice it to say, Acapulco was not the tourist center it has become. As we used to joke, you could still drive in the city. The hotel we stayed at was called Hotel Papagayo, and it has not been there for a few decades. The rooms were small and cozy, and it sat on a large property where we kids could go get lost and even play with deer that lived on the property. After the morning at the beach across the Costera Miguel Alemán at Hornitos Beach. These days, it is a working-class beach. It had the softest and finest sand I have ever experienced, and the waves were quite small, therefore safe for children to play in the water. The palapas, none brought their own umbrellas, were rented out, and you could eat fish and coconut right on the beach. But it was a Christmas dinner that was different. Given we are Jewish, it was a different affair from the fun and games of Hanukkah, where it was far less formal. The hotel had an open-air eating hall, which was decked with lights and deer, not reindeer. Rudolph was missing, and the biggest Christmas tree you have ever seen. I was 7 or 8 at the time, so I suppose any tree would be huge. Yet this was a pine tree in an area of Mexico known as Tierra Caliente, hot land, where palm trees are common, as well as other tropical plants. This tree was probably brought from near Mexico City, where pine trees are common due to the elevation. There is one more important detail. There were no gifts under the tree. The music leading to the affair was a classic posada, and the meal itself was festive, with turkey and rice and vegetables. There was also dessert, usually yellow cake or flan. For those who wanted it, there was salted cod, Veracruzana style, which is a tomato-based sauce, hot peppers, and vegetables. We never ordered it out of fear that the fish was still salty. When it comes out of a barrel, the dried out husk is covered in a thick crust of salt and fully dehydrated. There were also Mexican candies to share, some made out of coconuts, which are very common in Acapulco. Others made out of tamarind paste with salt and chili. We kids loved them, and we always took some home when the holiday was over, and we went back to school on January 2nd. Why, you might ask, there were no presents under the tree? In Mexico, like many other countries, that was the first day of Advent that ended on January 6th, when the three wise men came to give the gifts at the manger to baby Jesus. Of course, we did not expect gifts of clothes, sometimes given for Christmas, or for that matter, toys for the wise men day. But in a way, those dinners, somewhat formal for a tropical area, are full of good memories. It was a time we did look forward to. In the spirit of the season, the Mexican wish is Feliz Navidad y Próspero Año Nuevo. Merry Christmas and a prosperous New Year. This is Nadine Abbott for KNSJ in Descanso and East County Magazine.
The East County Magazine show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.
You're listening to the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia, and the Smashing Beats. Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.